Today is Monday, August 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
We see, for example, the capacity for us to get fresh water to 6 million Syrians. This is the law of war in action. We see every time a wounded combatant passes a checkpoint to get access to medical assistance, it's the laws of war in action.
That was Helen Durham, Director of International Law and Policy for the International Committee of the Red Cross, on the impact of the Geneva Conventions, which are marking their 70th anniversary. Also ahead, new research shows alarming effects of heat surges on coral reefs, and negotiators report progress as the 8th round of U.S. Taliban talks wrap up. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Well, as events marking the 70th anniversary of the 1949 Geneva Conventions get underway, the International Committee of the Red Cross says these four landmark treaties delineating the law of war are as relevant today as they are when they came into force August 12, 1949. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The 1949 Geneva Conventions grew out of the horrors of World War II. It took only 4 months for the four treaties, which are universally ratified, to come into force. The treaties contain the core elements of the international humanitarian law, the law of war, which aims to reduce suffering in armed conflict. The law requires all parties to a conflict to abide by provisions that include a prohibition against torture, appropriate treatment of civilians, caring for the wounded on the battlefield, and the dignified treatment of the remains of the dead. ICRC Director of International Law and Policy, Helen Durham, recognizes the law of war is not always followed, but she notes when they work, they have an impact. She says ICRC delegates in the field see these laws in action every day.
We see, for example, the capacity for us to get fresh water to 6 million Syrians. This is the law of war in action. We see every time a wounded combatant passes a checkpoint to get access to medical assistance, it's the laws of war in action.
At the same time, Durham acknowledges the many challenges to the conventions posed by new technologies. She says issues such as cyber warfare, artificial intelligence, autonomous weapons, and the changing nature of conflict present new threats. When the conventions were crafted 70 years ago, she says international wars among belligerent states dominated. Now, most wars are internal civil conflicts. She tells VOA, as far back as the 1970s, a survey found a dramatic increase in civilian casualties as a consequence of this change.
In World War I, I think the statistics are 1 out of 9 people killed was a civilian. In World War II, it was around 50-50. And then when we looked at the Vietnam and other wars of decolonization, the statistics inversed, where up to 90% of casualties during conflict were civilians. To date, that continues. So civilians are very often the major casualties.
Durham says an area of major concern for the ICRC is the treatment of detainees. She says clear rules governing the care of prisoners of war are laid out in the conventions. However, these frequently are not enforced in the context of civil wars where non-state actors are involved. She says this is one area where international law must evolve to make the laws of war more relevant to present-day existing reality. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Among the top stories in the world, Hong Kong police say they arrested 149 violent protesters from Friday to Monday and that some threw gasoline bombs. Muslims took part in the Stoning the Devil ritual today as part of the Hajj pilgrimage. The lockdown in the disputed Kashmir region continued for the 8th day, with streets mostly deserted in the Islamic holy day. The White House says it will ban green cards for immigrants who use public assistance, effective in October. And Argentine voters dealt a heavy blow to President Mauricio Macri in the primary election, shocking financial markets. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Marine heat waves are a much bigger threat to coral reefs than previously thought, according to research from Australia. It says bursts of heat are killing reefs almost instantly, leaving the coral with no chance of recovery. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Severe marine heat waves have been shown to cause mass bleaching in coral, which destroys its colourful symbiotic algae that are its main source of nutrition and can cause the coral to starve. Since 2016, warmer waters on the Great Barrier Reef have killed off about half of the coral on Australia's greatest natural treasure. But new research shows that as well as triggering bleaching, heat waves can directly kill the coral itself. Scientists suggest that severe heat wave-induced mortality events are a distinct biological phenomenon which inflicts damage that's different from coral bleaching. The study asserts that if water temperatures are so warm, the coral animal doesn't bleach, it dies, and its underlying skeleton is all that's left. The research team has used a CT, or computerized tomography scan, to help determine their results. Imogen Zathoven is the strategic director of the Australian Marine Conservation Society.
We've got a crisis on our hands with the warming of the oceans, even at 1 degree above pre-industrial levels of carbon emissions, that corals are dying immediately from severe heat stress. We have to act urgently. We have to act and drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
The study has been published in the journal Current Biology. It involved researchers from four Australian universities and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. The Great Barrier Reef in northeastern Australia is about the size of Japan. It's home to an array of marine creatures, including 600 types of coral, 500 varieties of worms, and more than 100 species of jellyfish. Scientists warn it's threatened not only by warmer ocean temperatures, but also overfishing, industrialization, and the runoff of pollution and pesticides from farms. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The United States and the Taliban have concluded the eighth round of talks aimed at reaching an agreement to end the 18-year-old war in Afghanistan and jumpstart intra-Afghan peace negotiations. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said the nine-day negotiations in Qatar wrapped up before dawn today on a day when Muslims around the world began celebrating their three-day annual festival of sacrifice known as Eid al-Adha. Without providing details, Mujahid said both sides agreed to consult their respective leaderships for next steps. The chief American negotiator, Zalmay Khalilzad, called the talks productive. In a series of tweets, he said he hopes this Eid is the last where Afghanistan is at war. Washington has said it is seeking a peace deal before the Afghan presidential election scheduled for September 28th. If finalized, the deal would outline insurgent guarantees that Afghan territory, particularly Taliban-controlled areas, will not be used for staging terrorist attacks against America or its allies in exchange for a timeline for the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign troops from the country. It would also require the Taliban to immediately start negotiations with stakeholders in Afghanistan, including envoys of the U.S.-backed government in Kabul, to discuss a nationwide ceasefire and matters related to future governance in the crisis-hit country. The U.S.-Taliban dialogue, however, has been under fire from the outset for excluding the Afghan government. The insurgent group refuses to recognize the Kabul administration as a legitimate entity, calling it a U.S. puppet. Well, the Pentagon Inspector General's report on the fight against ISIS says the terror group is resurging in Iraq and Syria less than 5 months after President Trump declared its caliphate there 100% defeated. The report said driving ISIS into the desert was not enough as long as its leadership remained relatively intact and restitution was practically guaranteed. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Allison McManus, Research Director at the Washington-based Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy about what is needed to counter the ISIS resurgence not only in Syria and Iraq, but also in North Africa and the Sahel.
The findings of the report are not surprising. When President Trump had made this statement about 100% defeat, I don't think that was taken at face value to begin with. And certainly since that time, despite the territorial gains that we've seen, there has been continued capacity to carry out attacks, as the report references, but more concerningly, the capacity to rebuild and to reconstitute. Also, what the report doesn't mention, as it focuses mostly on Iraq and Syria, is the continued capacity for the Islamic State to operate around the world. We've seen continued attacks in North Sinai in Egypt and in the mainland in Egypt. We saw an increase in attacks in Libya when Haftar did his advance towards Tripoli in April. And we've also seen continued activity in West Africa, Asia, and Central Africa. So the overwhelming message of the report that the Islamic State has not been defeated, is continuing to carry out attacks, and remains a serious threat is not surprising.
The report also said that driving ISIS into the desert was not enough to fully defeat it as long as its leadership remained relatively intact and reconstitution was practically guaranteed. In your opinion, what was missing in the fight against ISIS?
I think what's missing was the focus on the territorial aspect of the Islamic State. It's really important here to underscore the ideological attraction of the Islamic State that remains, and to recognize that as long as this appeal exists and there exists a recruitment pool, they'll be able to replenish forces from around the world. We recently even saw two Americans that attempted to join the Islamic State through Egypt. One of the things that the report underscored there is how we can't decouple the security concerns from political, economic, and social concerns. So just to focus on a military solution as a way to defeat ISIS on the ground won't be able to actually destroy its networks and undercut its ability to recruit. One of the things that the report underscored is that the U.S. drawdown came at a wrong time, but we have to consider the U.S. troops aren't going to be able to stay in Iraq and Syria forever. So thinking about what could be done now and what will need to come next to help to support the partner forces on the ground to actually be able to work together and to understand what some of the political dynamics are that have led to incoherence or inability to work together already. And also to consider the lack of service delivery that's going on in the region that provides frustration and greater success recruiting. Similarly, rights abuses and continued conflict, all of these will continue to create fertile ground for recruitment and for reconstitution.
So how could the U.S. and its allies counter this resurging, especially if ISIS fighters would move to ungoverned areas in North Africa and the Sahel?
So immediate measures would be to resolve the situation in the Al-Hol camp, where there are fighters that are being held, but mostly it's women and children that are being held there. However, we've seen continued extremist recruitment that's been going on in that camp. So at the very least, to address the humanitarian situation, to try to undercut some of the ability to recruit, but also to support reintegration efforts for populations that are there that have not been involved in acts of violence. I think continuing to work to build the capacity of local partner forces is another obvious step that needs to happen, and making those commitments clear. So not announcing withdrawal or drawdown and then sort of walking that back. I mean, making clear what the U.S. and allies are able to commit to in that area is important. But finally, I think considering the extremist violence as a transnational and generational problem that's not even just limited to the Islamic State and is certainly not limited to Iraq and Syria, we need to think about the fact that we have a large population of children who have now grown up in conflict, who have not had access to proper education and who have experienced severe psychological trauma. So there needs to be a push to resolve the conflict and for accountability on all sides as a mechanism for transitional justice, as well as support for regional states to be able to provide services. And finally, I think looking again across the region, a pressure to stem egregious rights abuses as a way to try to engender greater stability.
That was Allison McManus, Research Director at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. Well, the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates met in Mecca today with Saudi King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the latest developments in Yemen. Yemen's southern separatists have seized control of the southern capital, Aden, from the internationally recognized government of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, but say they will continue to work with the Saudi-led coalition. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates met in Mecca Monday with Saudi King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the latest developments in Yemen. Yemen's southern separatists have seized control of the southern capital Aden from the internationally recognized government of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, but say they will continue to work with the Saudi-led coalition. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo. Arab media showed the UAE's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed meeting with the Saudi king as the Crown Prince looked on. The visit coincided with the capture of government buildings in the southern Yemeni capital Aden by the country's southern separatists in recent days. The separatists have reportedly agreed to attend a meeting in Saudi Arabia to iron out their differences with the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen's internationally recognized government of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi. Separatist leader Idrous al-Zubaydi indicated in a speech Sunday that his forces would continue to cooperate with the coalition. He says that his side is ready to behave as a faithful and reliable ally and to act on the ground with total transparency, insisting that his men will respect the ceasefire that the Saudi coalition has called for. Southern separatist militia commander Mukhtar al-Nubi indicated that his forces were just about finished mopping up after taking control of most of Aden, including the presidential palace, from President Hadi's forces. He says that his forces have won a major victory in the southern capital, Aden, and that a number of divisions loyal to the separatists have just about accomplished the task of taking full control of the region. Interior Minister Ahmed al-Maisari admitted that his forces had been defeated by the southern separatists, claiming that the UAE had given their militiamen sufficient arms to capture Aden. He says that he is admitting defeat, but claims that this will not be the last battle. He says with irony that he thanks his opponents for robbing and destroying houses and vehicles of Hadi's forces, and claims that the separatists are behaving just like the Houthis in the north of the country. He claims that the recent battle was foisted on his forces by the UAE, which heavily armed the separatists. Yemen's former ambassador to Syria, Abdul Wahab Tawaf, told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that the UAE has armed militias loyal to the Hadi government to retake territory from the Houthis in the north, but have also armed the southern separatists, bringing about the situation we are now facing. The separatists, he says, have captured the institutions of state in the south and are attacking all of their opponents. Gulf analyst Theodore Karasik tells VOA that the separatists' latest actions are meant to force a negotiation to occur in Riyadh about the future of Yemen. He stresses that part of that discussion will be about whether it is useful to split the country in order to settle specific issues. Arab media outlets with ties to Qatar, long at loggerheads with both Saudi Arabia and the UAE, claim that ties between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi have been strained over the latest developments in Yemen, but Karasik disputes the claim. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
UN agencies report more than 2 million people in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua are struggling to feed their families. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An assessment carried out by the World Food Programme, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and government institutions finds 5 years of drought and excessive rains have decimated maize and bean crops in the so-called dry corridor of Central America. This geographical area is a tropical dry forest ecosystem that runs from southern Mexico to Panama. The UN agencies say the area has been battered by the El Niño phenomena and abnormal weather related to climate change. And this, they say, has resulted in crop failure, ruined harvests, and growing food shortages. When farmers lose their crops and have no money to buy food, WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says they often migrate to cities, neighboring countries, or further afield.
8% of families indicated that they were going to resort to migration, which the assessments classifies as an extreme coping strategy. Migration is not a solution. When a person migrates, those who are left behind continue to suffer from the cause of the migration, and it takes almost 5 years to economically recover when one person migrates.
The UN assessment team finds 1.4 million of the 2 million people in the dry corridor affected by abnormal weather are in urgent need of food assistance. WFP reports it plans to provide aid to more than 700,000 of the most vulnerable. Besides providing food aid, WFP says it also will help farmers adapt to climate change, this to make them more resilient to extreme weather events that are taking a heavy toll on their crops. The agency says it needs $72 million to pay for this humanitarian operation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, eczema is an itchy skin condition that's common in children, but it can occur at any age. No one knows what causes it, and there's no cure. VOA's Carol Pearson looks at the latest treatment for eczema.
Stephanie Seeger recalls what it was like when her daughter Ava developed eczema as a toddler.
We were trying to get that under control, and then all of a sudden she got these food allergies at the same time, around 18 months old.
It wasn't a coincidence, according to Dr. Donald Lee Young.
Probably a third of patients with eczema develop food allergy.
This link is known as the atopic march, a sequence of allergic diseases that starts with eczema and progresses to allergies and asthma. Dr. Leung is an allergist at National Jewish Health, a research hospital in Denver, Colorado.
These people have dry, cracked skin, which allows allergens from the environment to penetrate through.
When a child scratches a patch of itchy eczema, he breaks the skin barrier so food or pollen particles can enter through the skin. Lee Young says this is what leads to allergies.
What we need to do is rebuild the skin barrier.
To do this, doctors recommend putting a child in a warm 20-minute bath, something this baby doesn't like at all. After drying off, Lee Young says ointment should be rubbed onto the child's skin.
That will create a film of water that then, if you put a sealant over it, that will trap the moisture from evaporating.
This method is what doctors call the soak and seal. Mitts can be put on a baby's hands to prevent scratching, and a head wrap can further seal in the moisture. Eczema is a troublesome skin condition. It's so itchy, it can interrupt sleep because it gets worse at night. It can interrupt a parent's sleep as well and interfere with a parent's ability to earn a living. Plus, there's the emotional impact of not being able to soothe a fussy baby. Christine Klein knows all about that now that her son's eczema is under control.
I can't even explain to you the relief that we've really gotten from it.
Or the value of preventing sometimes deadly food allergies or asthma.
If we could try this now and we could prevent those food allergies, that's huge.
Researchers are working to develop a way to test every element of the skin so they can identify what weakens the skin barrier. Then they can find a way to repair it before children develop eczema or related health problems. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Daniel Brown, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.